It's Film Week on 89.3 KPCC. I'm Larry Mantle. Wonderful to have you with us. And I'm joined this week by Amy Nicholson, our Film Week critic, who does reviews for the film critic and film writer for The Guardian, hosts the podcasts Unspooled and the miniseries podcast Zoom, and Tim Cogshell, film critic for Alt Film Guide and Cinegods.com. We begin with The Current War Director's Cut, a biographical drama directed by Alfonso Gomez Rejon, tells the story of the race between Thomas Edison and George Westinghouse to determine which electrical system would power the world. Benedict Cumberbatch stars as Edison, Michael Shannon as Westinghouse.
Oh, you got vultures in every venture, but you just got to keep them away.
So this is just how it works.
Map makers include mistakes in their work to see if anyone else is copying them. Well, I don't have that luxury. I can't invent streets to lead the world down. Otherwise, we all end up in the dark.
Thomas Alva Edison is a charlatan who preys on the fears of the common man because I have the better system. And because I do have the better system, Westinghouse Electric shall endure.
The Current War Director's Cut, Michael Mitnick, the screenwriter, Alfonso Gomez Rejon, the director. Amy, what'd you think?
Yeah, I mean, this is the sort of film that I feel like is engineered for me by the brilliant minds of Hollywood, because it's set in the 1890s, you know, this decade of discovery and invention. You know, movies are invented this decade. Light bulbs are invented. This movie has a big part to do with the 1893 Chicago World's Fair, you know, this pivotal,
highly influential
in
event. Yeah,
absolutely. And of course, this is a movie that I love because it's a movie about how Edison is kind of a villain. You know, we've seen pictures before that touch on this current war between Tesla and Edison over the fight over whether electricity that gets piped into our homes should be AC, which was Tesla's argument, or DC, which was Edison's argument. And as people might know from history, to prove his point, Edison argued that Tesla's system would electrocute people and kill people who were working on it. And so this really gets into that battle, into like Edison secretly trying to design the electric chair just so he can blame it on Tesla's current and all of these wicked things that Edison did that I really enjoy. But I think what makes this film special is that it gives more of a role to Michael Shannon as George Westinghouse and kind of talking about the financial risks that both of these men were taking. And it kind of sets up the world that we see today. You know, not just dreamers and inventors, but the money that rules their fortune and that kind of rules our country still. So I enjoyed this a lot. I mean, it's done in kind of a modernish style. There's lots of like canted angles and close-ups and beautiful cinematography of fields full of light bulbs. And it has this kind of neat electronic skittery score that really fits well.
Now, this was a Weinstein Company film that was done a couple years ago, right? Was it recut?
Yeah, I think a few things happened. This film first played at the Toronto Film Festival, I believe, in 2017. So right before the Weinstein Company went bankrupt for very good reasons, of course, as we all know. And I think I feel like the phrase director's cut really adds kind of a hint to the backstory here. Like, I don't know if this film was recut by Weinstein and it was never exactly what the director himself wanted. You know, Alfonso Gomez Rejon, people know him from Mean Girl and the Dying Girl. I don't know if they were having a fight about this behind the scenes because the film did not get good reviews necessarily out of Toronto. In this cut, I liked it a lot. I thought it had a beautiful modernist edge. And I feel like it's their way of also saying, this is ours. This does not have anything to do with that man.
And the backstory on the film, you can find out more about because John Horn of The Frame interviewed the director, Alfonso Gomez Rejon, and you'll find a link to that conversation on our Film Week page. But sounds like this one you highly recommend people see this week.
I do. It feels both modern and a little bit classic, you know, just to have one of these big period pieces that's done in a style that I found fresh. Also, Michael Shannon is one of my top two favorite actors, so I'm
I know
a
you're a huge Shannon fan. The Current War Director's Cut, rated PG-13 in wide release. Also out this week, Black and Blue, an action drama directed by Dion Taylor, Naomi Harris, and Tyrese Gibson star. Harris plays rookie cop in New Orleans who has to deal with a challenge as she witnesses misconduct of other officers.
I don't know what's going on, but you can't be in here.
I've been shot.
What? What do you mean?
Can't use the phone.
Who shot you?
Can't use your phone.
You gotta go. I don't want no parts of this. The police is riding around here all the time. They'll help you.
It was the cops that shot me.
Black and Blue is written by Peter A. Dowling. It's unrated, Tim?
Yeah. Peter Dowling wrote Flight Plan, Jodie Foster movie back in 2005. Deion Taylor is among the most prolific African-American filmmakers working today. I'm sure most people don't know his name, but you've probably been watching his movies. I talked about The Intruder a little bit earlier this year, Megan Good, Dennis Quaid movie. A year before that, Traffic, Paula Padd movie, Omar Epps. A little bit before that, Meet the Blacks, Mike Epps in that movie.
Yeah.
Every year he knocks one down. He's got four films at in some stage of production right this very second, this guy, Deion Taylor.
It's and like a movie, TV director.
Oh, he knocks them out by the dozen. And this one, Black and Blue, which is a film that I like, despite the fact that it has holes you can drive a truck through in this movie. But I enjoy it anyway. This is a one good cop movie, right? You got this young rookie cop, and she's apparently the only good cop in all of the New Orleans Police Department.
Sir Serpico again.
He's kind of Serpico-y, yeah. You know, which apparently was true at one point, not long after Katrina. That police department had some real serious problems, so it sort of built out of that a little bit. She witnessed this thing, Frank Grillo playing the bad guy that Frank Grillo often plays in these movies. He kills this little kid from the hood. He convinces the gangsters in the hood that she did the job, too. So now you got the cops after her, and you got the gangsters after her, and she and Tyrese Gibson have to do that thing that happens in these movies. Now, there are about 10,000 things this young cop can do to get herself out of this situation, all of which must be ignored. Because if we acknowledge any of them, the movie's over.
Pay no attention.
Pay no attention to all of the ways that we can make this stop. But, you know, I like the pacing of this movie. I like Naomi Harris with that gun. First saw no, I remember her. She was in a Bond movie. It was the first time. I think she played Moneypenny or somebody in a Bond movie or a replacement for Moneypenny. That was my first time with her, that Academy Award nomination for that mom in Moonlight. She can act.
Yeah, that was an extraordinary performance.
She's really, really good in this movie. Again, holes you can drive a truck through, but yeah.
Yeah. I always find Gibson a compelling screen presence, too.
Yeah.
What did you think, Amy?
Yeah, I mean, I'm very much with Tim on this. I mean, this is just a copsploitation scream at the screen picture, but I had a lot of fun with it with an audience. You can tell, I almost feel like the holes are there on purpose, that the whole audience is kind of groaning together, and yet we really like this film, even though it's bad on many rubrics, you know? It's hard to say that this is a good
preposterous
film.
Fun.
And yet it was right there. I mean, it's so clear-cut in its world of, like, good versus bad in the points it's trying to make it, that, you know, it lets you just hiss at a villain. It's basically the Snidely Whiplash of modern films with a touch of relevance, given that we are talking about body cam footage, which I almost feel like they could have played with a little bit more, you know, because the bad cops should be wearing body cams too. And I kept thinking, wouldn't it be fun if we were watching the cops figure out how to act right for their cameras while doing evil things behind their back, sort of.
It's just, like, you know, evil Frank magician. Mike Coulter shows up in the film. We know Mike played Luke Cage on Netflix, and he's playing a bad guy with these gold teeth and, you know, bad with the leather, with the fur and all this kind of stuff. Mike's not a bad guy.
Black and Blue is the film. It's rated R. Deion Taylor, the director, and it's in wide release. 17 Blocks, a documentary directed by Davey Rothbart, which takes us inside the story of the Sanford family. What's that story, Tim?
This is an absolutely devastating, powerful, deeply, deeply moving film. I happened to host the IDA panel that Davey
International Documentary Association.
And this movie, 17 Blocks is how far the community, the black community, black and brown community, is from the Capitol building where Davey started following this family in 1999. In this family, there was a little boy, 9 years old at the time, named Emmanuel. And Emmanuel saw Davey hanging around with this camera, and Davey just gave the camera to Emmanuel, and Emmanuel started shooting his own family. This movie goes on for 20 years. This goes on for 20 years. Now, there's a thing that happens in the 10th year of this film that's absolutely devastating. We've been watching that little boy, Emmanuel, grow up, and a horrible thing happens. And they keep making the movie for another 10 years, and it's absolutely devastating, but it's a beautiful film in a particular way, too.
When you say Capitol, you mean U.S. Capitol?
The U.S.
there in D.C.?
Yeah, right behind D.C., this impoverished, crime-ridden community where this family is growing up, where this little boy is growing up. And we see this little boy go from being 9 to being 19. He's about to become a fireman. He's managing a rock group. It's just this fantastic, fantastic little boy. And I've talked to Davey about this, and he does not mind this. This is not a spoiler. At 19, he's killed. This little boy that we've been watching in this movie for 10 years is killed. And the family is devastated. But his mother says, just keep making the movie. Keep making. They make 10 more years worth of movie. It's a very interesting thing that happens.
17 Blocks, the documentary, can be seen at Lemley's Monica Film Center in Santa Monica. It's unrated. Coming up, we'll talk about Countdown, a horror film, which of course Tim went to see. He's always good to checking out the new horror film. We'll continue on Film Week on KPCC.
Heading for heartbreak and pain. Had a little sweet spot for the rain. For rain and skies of gray.
That, of course, Bruce Springsteen, Hello Sunshine, off his album Western Stars, which came out earlier this year. You're listening to Film Week on 89.3 KPCC. Tim Kobachel and Amy Nicholson are critics this week. And the live concert documentary Western Stars, with Bruce Springsteen performing the material from the album, is out this week in select theaters. Tim, what'd you think of this?
Performing all of the material from the album, every single bit of it, with some new arrangements or whatnot. Here's the deal. I kind of tapped out on Bruce in about 95. So, you know, not a big Bruce Springsteen fan myself. Go to see this in a public screening. Obviously, everybody in the room, big fans of Bruce and thoroughly enjoying this movie. It is a lovely film that delves deep into the history of Bruce, particularly his young life. It's in this barn, a 100-year-old barn that's on his property, the gigantic orchestra.
It's quite a place. I've seen it.
Yeah. I've been there, but breathtaking. Yeah. Place, and it's just lovely. Everybody's there. Patty is there. All his friends. He's telling stories. It's not exactly that concert that he did. I mean, he had that one-man show.
Which I thought was quite impressive.
Yeah. You know, and it's a lot of the same stories. The music is lovely, absolutely all of it. But here's the thing. When did Bruce become a cowboy? If I'm not mistaken, Bruce is from Jersey.
He's a New Jersey cowboy.
And I don't quite get all of that, but this is all presented. It's just a sort of Western thing. And, you know, I grew up loving Bruce. I'm a Bruce guy. But Bruce was not a cowboy when I was hanging out with him. On the radio, but he's like this full-on cowboy now, and this happens to the weirdest people. Jeff Bridges, born in L.A., cowboy. You notice Jeff Bridges is a cowboy? I don't know when he became Dylan. Dylan's a cowboy.
So kind of makes you appreciate the great character actor Ben Johnson, who really was
who was
a
cowboy,
came to Hollywood to use his wrangling skills becomes an Oscar-winning actor.
It's just the oddest thing, and I'm not sure that most people notice it, but I noticed it. I don't remember when he became a cowboy.
Western Stars, the performance documentary of Bruce Springsteen, his album Western Stars. It's rated PG. It must be some mature singing. It's in selected theaters. Also this week, the horror film Countdown, which is written and directed by Justin Deck. Tim?
Yeah, Justin. This is his debut feature film, but Justin's been working around movies for a long, long time. So Justin is a hand at making movies. This is Final Destination. This is the Grim Reaper film. Grim Reaper's actually even in the film. You know, skinny, black, long fingers and all that kind of stuff. I'm like, okay, Grim Reaper film. He doesn't have a scythe. He has an app. Okay, fine. People, you have these people. The funniest thing happens in this movie. Everybody says, oh, this is app that'll tell you when you're going to die. And immediately everybody downloads the app. Who are these people who downloads an app that's going to tell you where you're going to die?
And does it glitch humorously real apps?
It's just a funny sort of thing. And then there's another very funny thing that everyone does in this movie. The very first thing that the app does is it makes you accept the user agreement, read this, and everybody just skips it and presses agree. Why do you do this?
So it sounds like it's a comedic horror film.
It's kind of funny in that kind. And then the young lady finds out she's going to only got 3 days to live. Everybody else is like 87 years, 45 years. She's only got 3 days. And the thing of it, if there's a problem with this movie, is that we know that it's all true. It's all happening. The movie sets itself up. Oh, is it real? Is it actually happening? Well, yeah, it's happening. You can see the thing. It's right there. The Grim Reaper is standing right there. So it's kind of fun in that way. The kills are pretty good. It's pretty taut and pretty tense and a lot of good, solid jump scares. But, you know, the Grim Reaper with an app, I don't know, man.
So maybe she downloads an update, she lives longer. Countdown is the horror film. It's rated PG-13. Justin Deck is the writer-director. Frankie, a film starring Isabelle Huppert. Ira Sachs is the director and co-screenwriter. Amy?
Yeah, this is the sort of film we tend to get every year, you know, starring Isabelle or Tilda Swinton or Juliette Binoche, about a wealthy family kicking it around a big mansion in Europe on vacation, drinking wine, talking about their problems, reconvening in different combinations to keep talking about their problems and their problems with each other.
Do they intermittently have sex between the talking or
not? Sometimes they do. How'd you guess?
I've seen this film.
Exactly. I feel like we've all kind of seen this film, but they're always kind of enjoyable, like having a nice glass of rosé on a beautiful day. And this is this version of that. Mm. I mean, it's got actors I adore in here. You know, Ira Sachs is the director of this one. People know him from like Love is Strange, and he's reconnecting with a lot of the actors that he really enjoys. You've got Marissa Tomei that he had in Love is Strange. You've got Greg Kinnear from Little Men playing a couple. They're working on the new Star Wars film, but they happen to wander into Portugal. Which, you know, kind of makes sense, I guess, when you see it.
It's what I call a walk and talk. Just about every scene of this movie eventually starts with two people, sometimes three, walking and talking down some lovely street in this Portugal. And they just walk and they talk. And then you cut to two more people and they walk and they talk. And the whole movie is just people walking and talking. Isabelle, the thing that we know in the movie, is she's the matriarch of this sort of odd little family that's put together. She's a French movie star. And we know that she is dying. That we know. But she's kind of slowly dying, like not dying right now.
She's stylishly dying.
She's got an app that gave her more time.
She looks fantastic. Because I'm thinking, she's dying? And I'm like, okay, Isabelle, she looks fantastic. And everyone is sort of like coming to grips with that in each other. She has her ex-husband there, who's plainly still in love with her.
And her current husband Brendan Gleeson.
You know, her ne'er-do-well son who wants to do something. So all of this is sort of going on, and they walk and they talk, and everybody looks lovely, and the cheese even looks like it tastes good in this movie. But you know, it's one of those.
Frankie, the film from Ira Sachs, the director and co-screenwriter with Mauricio Zacharias, the film rated PG-13. It's at the Arclight Hollywood and Lemley's Royal Theater in West Los Angeles. The Kill Team, an action film set in Afghanistan. Nat Wolff and Alexander Skarsgård are the stars. Dan Krause, the writer-director. Tim?
Yeah, The Kill Team. Dan Krause, who wrote and directed this movie in 2013, made a documentary about these actual events and this actual young man. A young soldier goes to Afghanistan. His father had been in the Marines, and he's kind of eager about, you know, contributing to the war. And he finds himself in this platoon with this sergeant who's just completely sadistic. And they're just flat out murdering people. So this happens in the documentary. So what Dan did is he took the narrative from the documentary and he worked it into this sort of feature film thing. It's a very intense film. It is thrilling and all of that kind of stuff. Knowing that this all actually happened, though, made it a little bit different for me. This is a narrative film, but understanding that this is representation of what that sergeant and these boys, they're like 19, were doing. They were following their sergeant and doing what he told them to do, and it was murder.
So it makes it difficult, sounds like, to take the film for entertainment value given the horror behind it.
Exactly. That's exactly how I feel.
Yeah, Amy?
Yeah, I mean, it's interesting how much the story seems to really compel Dan Krause to keep trying to tell it over and over and over again, and to go from documentary to narrative film in this, where you sense that the idea of making it fiction lets him stretch a bit. He gets to change the names. He gets to really put together the scenes that show how a really soft-spoken sociopath, is the way that Alexander Skarsgård plays him, grooms these boys to want his approval. And all of that's fairly interesting. It's actually the second half that I found the most compelling, where you have to deal with the mistakes you've made. And when it's almost sort of like Black and Blue in a little bit, like when the people who are supposed to be your brothers in arms, your sisters in arms, turn on you, how do you deal with feeling isolated in this community?
Mm-hmm.
That stuff I find actually more interesting than the rest of it. And I find the last 30 minutes the most interesting of all, but he doesn't seem to explore it as much as I wish he would.
We're talking about The Kill Team from Dan Krause. He's the writer-director of it. Nat Wolff and Alexander Skarsgård star. It's rated R at Lemley's Music Hall in Beverly Hills. Paradise Hills, a Spanish science fiction fantasy, stars Emma Roberts and Danielle McDonald. Awkwafina is also in the cast. Alice Waddington is the director, and the screenwriters are Brian DeLue and Nacho Vigalondo. Amy?
Yeah, this is a film that if I was 15 years old and having a slumber party with my friends, I would 100% want to put on. It's sort of a teenage girl fairy tale fable with beautiful costuming and cinematography. It looks amazing. The story here is it's this boarding school for disobedient girls. People have been sort of unruly. You know, they're not behaving in the way their wealthy family wants them to behave. They don't look as beautiful as their family wants them to be. And it's this kind of brainwashed Stepford Daughters movie in a way that's done in this neo-futuristic style where the girls are dressed half like bondage and half like Renaissance paintings.
Yeah.
It's beautiful costuming. And you have Mia Jovovich as this kind of like very feminine girl dressed always in roses, brainwashing these girls and trying to corrupt them and starve them and diet them and make them behave. I mean, the messages here of being an independent woman and trying to figure out how to be a girl on your own are kind of obvious.
Mm.
But it did feel modern in touches of, like, there's a little bit of sexual fluidity happening in here.
Yeah, that whole weird thing with the girl who kept kissing and touching on Emma Roberts and Emma looking at her like, why are you kissing and touching on me? It's you know, I for a long time I had no idea what the hell was going on in this movie. And, I mean, it crosses about three or four different genres, actually.
Yeah, the even, gothic part is the best.
Oh, my God. It even becomes like a vampire movie for like 30 seconds. and then it changes genres again. And I'm like, you know what? I'm out. I tapped out.
No. All right. Paradise Hills is the film. Emma Roberts stars Alice Waddington, the director, Brian DeLue, Nacho Vigalondo, the screenwriters. It's unrated. You can see it at Lemley's Monica Film Center. And coming up, we'll hear about the documentary Fantastic Fungi, which I'm sure it's fantastic. We'll hear what Amy has to say about that, as well as a look at the great movie palaces of the past, going attractions. You're listening to Film Week on 89.3 KPCC. And want to remind you, coming up on Saturday night, November 2nd, Blade Runner, The Final Cut, Theater at Ace Hotel. It's our next Film Week screening. I hope you'll join us for that. Tickets at kpcc.org/in-person. I just want to remind you that you're listening to Film Week on 89.3 KPCC. Joining me this week are critics Amy Nicholson and Tim Cogshell. Next up is the documentary Fantastic Fungi. Louis Schwartzberg is the director. Amy, how exciting is a documentary on fungi?
Very. I mean, if you, I don't think I have to tell people what mushrooms can do. This movie is very much set out to be a documentary that is a mind-blowing trip about the world of fungi. But first, just to set this up, this is a film with beautiful time-lapse photography. Over and over and over again, fungi growing, making things break apart, decomposing, mushrooms just sprouting up. Beautiful, beautiful, beautiful camera work here that I think they expect you to be enjoying with maybe a little bit of extra fun in your system. But what this documentary is really setting out to do is also mind-blowing in a completely different way. I mean, this documentary tells me things that I did not understand about the fungus world that really, really awakened my eyes. And I mean, part of what this film wants us to know about mushrooms and the fungus system is that mushrooms and the network that we have underneath the ground, they are one of the most powerful weapons we have in terms of absorbing carbon from the atmosphere and processing it, taking it out of the planet and trying to actually make it useful again. They call it the digestive tract of the planet. And they have experiments that they go over here where fungi are able to break down oil spills, for example, in the ocean, that they have all these uses we have really not been tapping for. They're a safe way of getting rid of termites and bed bugs. You know, they are they are really untapped. And so this documentary is basically us following around a lot of guys in colorful T-shirts with mushrooms on them. Very psychedelic. Everybody has a beard. Everybody's a fantastic hippie. One man talks about the first time he ate the other kind of mushroom and sits in a tree and he watched a lightning storm come. And we get a whole beautiful reenactment for that if you want to really get in his headspace. A lot of fractals happening in here. There's a fun kind of CG flashback of the early primates who they theorize developed language after eating magic mushrooms. I mean, if you are at all a mushroom head, this is a movie for you.
This reminds me of back when marijuana was illegal. You'd get these documentaries about hemp and the amazing things that hemp, you know, touting it for all but curing cancer.
Yeah, yeah.
And so we have a mushroom movie. It sounds like it's in that vein.
You know what? I'm sold. I am absolutely sold.
It's Fantastic Fungi. We're talking talking about Louis Schwartzberg's film. It's at Lemley's Monica Film Center in Santa Monica and unrated. Going Attractions, the definitive story of the movie palace. Also a documentary this week from director April Wright. Tim.
Yeah, the movie palace. I know I like this a bit more than Amy, so I'm going to gush a little bit about this film. Movie palaces, not just theaters. Although the film begins literally with the Nickelodeon. You put the nickel in there and you put your head in the thing and watch the thing. And then we start to grow. And one of the things that happened first was that the old vaudeville houses became these palaces, these theaters. And I did not know that. I did not know that the very, very first palaces had been vaudeville houses. And then we meet all of these interesting sort of characters. In this documentary that's very ordinarily made, you have your talking heads, Chicago, Los Angeles, New York, the places where the big palaces have been, who know a lot about the theater palaces of those towns, talking to us and telling us about them. Now, a good third of this film is set right here in Los Angeles, down there on Broadway.
Yeah, South Broadway, Theater at Ace Hotel, United Artists Flagship, where we do our... The Orpheum, the Los Angeles, the Million Dollar, the list goes on and on in movie palaces.
Yeah, not to mention all the stuff that Sid built, the Chinese and all that. These wonderful movie palaces, and talking about them decade by decade. So we start to see that point in the early 60s when these things start to go down. People stop going to the movies, television and all kinds of things are going on. Radio City Music Hall, 5,000 seats there.
Nearly raised.
Yeah. Came that close. So it's just, to me, it was really a fascinating little historical walk across the, and now we have another sort of interesting thing going on, even including the Egyptian here in Los Angeles, interesting things going on there. We've restored many of the great movie palaces here, but down there on Broadway, you know, a lot of those movie palaces are still like, you know, jewelry stores.
They were converted to other uses, sometimes roughly around the edges. One thing I love, too, and Amy, I'll let you review the film, but I love how the movie theater tells the story of Los Angeles's westward move, because downtown Los Angeles, South Broadway, the place where all the big premieres and the center of, you know, the prime movie-going experience, then it moves to Hollywood with Sid Grauman's Egyptian Theater and then his bigger Chinese theater with the Pantages and others, and then it moves to Westwood. The West Side becomes the dominant area of expansion.
And the Bruin and all of that.
And the Carthay Circle Theater, which sadly was lost to spectacular movie palace. Amy, what do you think of the film?
Yeah, I mean, as you're kind of pointing out, like, you can't tell the history of these giant palaces without telling the history of the entire cinema business. And I think that's where I got a little bit restless because, yeah, we know the story of, like, the rise and decline, you know, to the exploitation houses, to the multiplexes, to the demi-revival that we're in now. So I did get a little restless because it just told in a way where if you know anything about cinema, you might know a lot of what's in here. But there were pockets that I found really interesting, and I was glad they kind of brought them forward, talking about how theaters really did function as entertainment democracy, where everybody could afford a ticket. It wasn't just for the rich. And yet you had men in, you know, tuxedos ushering you around, having it feel like a special night out. And I was thinking about our nights at the Ace, because a person talks about getting to visit the bathrooms and in movie theaters like that, how big of a deal the men's smoking room and the women's powder room felt, that you were stepping into another world. So it was lovely hearing a firsthand memory like that.
The Los Angeles Theater's women's room is unbelievable. It's sometimes part of the walking tour the LA Conservancy does. It's spectacular. It's like, how did they get women out of the restroom to go see the movie?
You know, when we do our Nights of the Ace, elegant. I just want to hang out in there. I'm like, can't we bring people down here?
Yeah, it's gorgeous. Going Attractions, the definitive story of the movie palace. April Wright is the director. It's at several of the Lemley's theaters starting October 28th, and it's unrated. Girl on the Third Floor, a horror film that's written and directed by Travis Stevens and stars CM Punk and Trieste Kelly Dunn. Amy?
Yeah, this is a haunted house movie that I actually enjoyed a lot. CM Punk, if people are familiar with that name or not, he is an ex-wrestler. He's a man who's covered in tattoos. And he's not an actor, but he does fine in this. This is a movie about a man who has a lot of anxieties about where his life is heading. He's bought this giant house as kind of a symbol of the fact that his wife is moving out here with their baby who is about to be born. And so he's decided to do one last manly thing, which is fix up this house. But it turns out to be a lot of cleaning up goo and ooze and Cronenbergian liquids, because this house is haunted by kind of the female pain. It used to be a brothel. And so this is a movie about a man who's about to make a lot of mistakes in his life in a house that's determined to help him make more of them. And it's kind of a fun look at at gender dynamics and at failed masculinity. It's not really that often that we get a horror film that's really looking at what is it like when your hero is very weak, even though he looks like the strongest man on earth. And he is fragile in a lot of interesting ways.
Well, and the different themes here, I mean, it sounds fascinating. Like, I mean, just looking at a very basic level, the house that you're trying to restore or to fix up that turns on you. I mean, that is, it's sort of a real world example of that many people have. But then adding all these gender dynamics of the former brothel law is fascinating.
Yeah, it's very, very symbolic. And in a way, I found it just very fascinating. This is a movie I hope people go and check out. It's a really interesting story that Travis is trying to tell here.
Just quickly, why do you think not a bigger release for it? It's just the low budget or?
I'm not sure. You know, I think a lot of horror films are expecting to be discovered on streaming afterwards. You know, they're expecting to live on, I guess, like a ghost from a brothel haunting a house.
They have such a loyal core audience for them.
Exactly. And they deserve them, you know, especially now that we're in this wave where filmmakers like Travis Stevens are adding in so much social relevance. It's not just a house that goes boo, it's masculine anxiety.
Right now, it's 71% on Rotten Tomatoes, which is higher than any of the wide releases this week. That's pretty interesting. Girl on the Third Floor, CM Punk, Trieste Kelly Dunn, writer-director Travis Stevens in his directorial debut. The film's unrated, and it's at Lemley's Music Hall Theater in Beverly Hills. It's Film Week on 89.3 KPECC, and we want to remind you that we are going to be at the Theater at Ace Hotel with our next Film Week screening. That's going to be coming up on Saturday night, November 2nd, 7 o'clock. Tickets, kpecc.org/in-person.